This is going to be a continuation of an idea that I discussed last week with regard to the fact that the Megillah goes to great lengths to describe the closeness of the relationship between Mordechai and Esther. That is, that he was Omein, he nursed her, and then he adopted her, and he raised her, and after she became the queen, he was in constant contact with her. And we said that the significance of this relationship comes to light after he discovers the news of the plan to destroy the Jews, and he tears his clothing, he goes forth in a manner of mourning with ashes on his head, and he screams a loud and bitter wail. And then he enters into a dialogue with Esther. His instruction was that Esther should go immediately to the king and plead for the Jews. Esther refuses, and it's a little bit difficult to understand what the argument is, because her point is sensible. She's saying that I don't have an appointment. And if I go there now, the policy is whoever doesn't have permission can be executed unless the king stretches forth the golden scepter. And I have not been called for 30 days. This seems to be a logical argument. It wasn't that Esther was refusing to help. We have to deduce that she was saying that it didn't make sense to go about it this way, because in this way she risked everything. She could be killed, and if she could be killed, no one would be helped. So rather, what she really meant was that I will do my best to secure an appointment. I'll go through the regular channels, and when I get an appointment, then I'll go and beseech the king. Mordechai was not satisfied with this, and he rebukes her in a very stinging kind of a manner by implying that she's only doing this because she wants to save herself, that she separated herself from the lot of the destiny of the Jewish people, and says, don't imagine that you'll save yourself in the house of the king, because if you're silent at this time, then salvation will come to the Jewish people, but you and your father's house will be destroyed. And who knows, if not for this moment, that you were appointed to be the queen. So he gives her a stinging rebuke. And the question, of course, is, why? What was wrong with her idea? Superficially, it seems that her idea makes more sense. Why is it better to go before the king unannounced, risk your life, and nobody gets help? What's wrong with getting an appointment? It seems that they still had enough time for that. There was plenty of time, a number of months, so she could get the appointment, and then she would do it in a more intelligent way. What was the argument between them? As we explained, Mordechai was conveying to her something about the strategy, what you need to do in a situation of extreme danger. You can't go about things in the normal channel. That's precisely why he went to extremes. He tore his clothing. He acted like a madman. He went into the street and gave up any semblance of dignity and propriety and screamed a loud and bitter wail. And he was telling her that if you go about this in the normal channels, that in and of itself will guarantee defeat, because there's tremendous forces against you. It's a very significant thing. There's a lot of energy behind the decision to kill the Jews, and they're going to do everything possible to thwart you. So right off the bat, they can tell. This is an important idea psychologically, not just for a situation in terms of dealing with life and death or anti-Semitism, but in general, when you're up against serious resistance, you're fighting for a just cause, and you need to get the attention of the authorities, and you know that they're arrayed against you. So they're taking note of your state of mind. If they sense that deep down you're just going through the motions, you're making a protest, a serious protest, but bottom line is that if you come up against a stone wall, you're going to back off, then pretty much you're not going to win. When you're fighting a certain type of a battle, you're fighting City Hall, so to speak, it's not going to be easy. From the outset, it's not going to be easy. But sometimes you see that protesters can be successful. And generally speaking, what gets people's attention is they sense, how strong you are about this, that this is something I'm willing to go to jail for, this is something I'm willing to give up my freedom for, this is something I'm willing to give up my life for. That gets people's attention. I'm not saying that's the only factor. But by and large, they already take note. They get a sense of how far you're willing to go. All right, so you gather a petition. That's very nice. You gather a petition. If you, a lot of causes, you go about it in an orderly kind of a way, then they already have their own methods of responding. Thank you very much. The president has received your petition. We're taking it under advisement. We're going to be thinking about it. It'll be coming up at the next meeting of the cabinet, so on and so forth. All this is pretty much a way, it's a kiss-off, so to speak. This is how the Jews acted during the Holocaust, the Jews in America. They went about things in the conventional way. They wrote the letters, they made the protests, they made the visits, they besieged, they did all these things, and the authorities had whatever they were very powerful forces arrayed against any effort to save the Jews, which is a different story, not for today. And they knew exactly how to handle it. They had conferences, they had meetings, we're trying our best, and they had explanations. And if the Jews decided to go about things through the normal channels, the normal channels basically closed the door on the Jews. And it wasn't really successful. The effort to get the president, the United States, to change its policy. And the policy essentially was not to do anything to save Jews. That's a tragic story. We'll take it up at a different time. This is one of the lessons that we learn from the Megillah. This is what Mordechai was communicating to Esther. That precisely the fact that you're going unannounced, precisely the fact that you can't wait, that you can't go through channels, that you're prepared to die, that is the most significant element in the entire intercession, in the entire intervention. And you see, subsequently to this, it does play a significant role. Although, Esther devised her own strategy. The question, of course, arises, if that was the idea of Mordechai, then why didn't Mordechai communicate that way? Mordechai should have explained his position. Because Esther had a legitimate answer. It's just that Mordechai disagreed and held that in a situation like this, you've got to take the risky course of action. But he didn't answer. To the contrary, he just attacked their motives. He impugned their motives. So, of course, the question is, why did he choose to do it that way? But to appreciate the significance of what he did, I want to bring an illustration. This past week, I saw the press conference of President Bush, very serious press conference, explaining what the situation was and the reasons why war against Iraq is necessary, it's imminent. Of course, he didn't actually declare war, but he made it very clear that unless his conditions were met, that is absolute, unconditional, complete disarmament to the shore of his weapons and so on and so forth, then that would be the consequence. And of course, he kept reiterating how he didn't want to go to war, but he has no other choice because his primary responsibility is the security of the United States of America, and nothing will deter him from that goal. And then, of course, he faced questions. He handled the questions. And there was one question that kept coming up. And he answered the questions. He kept returning to his basic message. It was a very serious type of a press conference, and I guess his objective was to keep reiterating the basic point, not to get away from the basic focus. And he even made the point that even if the United Nations does not go along with him, the Security Council doesn't go along with him, it's not going to deter him, because when it comes to the defense of the United States of America, which is his primary responsibility, he's not going to be affected by what other people think. He's going to do what he considers to be his responsibility. This question now, however, came up, because he kept saying that there's no doubt about the nature of the weapons that they have, and the fact that they have not been in compliance and they're not in cooperation. And he was citing all of the intelligence that we have, all the telephone intercepts and so on, the satellites, and so on and so forth, that the evidence that we have that he's not in compliance is absolutely overwhelming, and essentially there's no room for doubt on this. Of course, he left himself a little bit vulnerable to the following question, and that is that they asked him, you've shared this information, and he made the point that he had shared this information with all of the allies, everybody else had this information. So how do you explain the fact that if it's so clear, why is it that, say, France and Germany don't see it that way? The information is that clear. So why do you think that they're not coming to the same conclusion you're coming to? That question kept being repeated. He never answered that question. If you go through the press conference, you can go through a transcript. He addressed other parts of the question, more or less was repeating the same thing, but never addressed it and said, I'll explain to you why, in spite of the overwhelming evidence, they do not come to this conclusion. After the news conference was over, so the various TV shows, the analysts, political analysts, were analyzing it. And on one show, the host, his name is O'Reilly, he's very sharp, very analytical, and the guest was former Speaker of the House, Newt Gingrich, for whom I have respect. He's, again, very analytical, he's a supporter of Israel, intelligent individual. And both of them in general praised the president's performance, but O'Reilly raised the question that he didn't answer that question. He didn't explain, and he was very troubled by it. He thought that he really should have answered that question. And why didn't he address himself to that? It's a good question. In all honesty, I felt the same way. When I listen to these press conferences, questions, so I also take note of whether I think the answer was a good answer, whether it wasn't a good answer, whether he dodged it, whether he faced it. And I noticed also that he didn't answer that question, and I assume, to a certain extent, I felt that he was dodging it. Maybe it would have been better. He should have answered it. It's a good question. The question was posed to Newt Gingrich. Why did Bush not answer that question? And Gingrich said that when he was Speaker of the House, he would have answered that kind of a question, and it would have been a mistake. Because the job of the president is not to analyze other people's motivations. His job is to present the case. His job is to present the facts. Now, you have to know, in effect, this is what he's saying, and I learned something from it. Because it took a lot of discipline. It takes a lot of discipline to refrain from answering certain questions, especially when you're being attacked. He's being attacked by a lot of different forces. So you want to defend yourself. You want to answer back. And in a situation like this, when you claim to have evidence and other people are not accepting it, and you know that it's because of deep motivations, because they have economic interests, because they have deals with Iraq and they're supplying them with parts and for weapons or whatever they're getting in terms of oil deals and so on and so forth. It's ulterior motives. That's all. That's the reason. If they didn't have these ulterior motives, they'd see the facts the same way. And they're not living up to their responsibilities of removing someone who's a serious threat to the world, to the region. He's a terrorist. He's a wicked individual. Kills innocent people. Of course, it's a big misfit to get rid of him. So the only thing you can do is to start to imply that type of thing, that these people obviously have other motives. What do you gain by doing that? You're just going to cause further animosity because they're not in a mode where they're going to listen to the truth. So even though you may be perfectly correct and perfectly logical, there's no gain in doing that at all. And there's only harm. So he was praising Bush, that he had the discipline to refrain. Therefore, you see, in today's world, when you get involved in arguments, you really can't, even if that's the real issue, is not that there's anything lacking in my argument. There's always a breakdown, let's face it. When you're having a discussion with a friend, or an argument, disagreement, or with your husband, or whatever it is, and either one of you, let's say, has the facts are on your side, the logic is on your side, and the only reason the person is resisting is because of a certain emotion. Now, generally speaking, when you say it's because you feel this way, it's because of that emotion, generally speaking, that's like, then who are you? Don't analyze me. Just stick to the facts. So it's very difficult. It's very difficult to confront somebody in that way. And especially in the public scene, that's not considered to be acceptable. That's like attacking the person. That's psychoanalyzing the person. Can't do that. So that basically, Bush was adhering to that. I can only present to you the evidence. I can't address the other person's motivations. Now, Mordechai did not do it that way. Mordechai didn't address himself to the substance. To the contrary, he only addressed himself to psychological motivation. In effect, he was saying, there's no need for me to answer you. The facts are very, very clear, and you know what I'm saying. You understand what I'm saying as well as I do. All you have to do is look within yourself, recognize whatever the emotions might be, which I will point out to you the direction. And when you free yourself from those emotions and you readjust your psyche in terms of the way it ought to be, then it'll be very, very clear what I'm saying. And as I explained, that's only possible because she trusted him. Not everybody can talk that way. It's a very interesting type of a thing. It's an interesting type of a phenomenon. We should appreciate the significance of the relationship between Mordechai and Esther. I think there's something very unique. There's something very significant and special when a person can talk to you that way. As I explained it, Bush was correct not to speak that way. But that's because he's operating in a situation which is far from ideal. In a world of denial, where people are not going to accept the truth. So then, if you point out certain psychological truths, it's only going to backfire. So from a strictly political point of view, Bush did the correct thing. But in an ideal world, where people are focused on discovering the truth, then you do have the possibility of pointing out to someone some type of a psychological resistance which is impeding them from seeing the truth. But that doesn't exist in most relationships. In order for that to be there, you have to have a relationship with someone in whom you have complete trust and confidence, so that when that person points something out to you, you won't be offended, but you'll open your heart to it and you'll listen. Then you gain enormously. In an ideal situation, it would have not as been effective if Mordechai had to explain the position, what the reasons are. Esther could see that for herself. What's much more important is for her to see and understand what prevented her from understanding it in the same way. As an illustration of this, a well-known rabbi, I won't mention the name, it's not necessary, even though what I'm talking about is on the public record, has just made a public acknowledgement of error with regard to a decision that he made, a significant one, which affected the Jewish community in a Beis Din that he was the head of. And he gives a lengthy apology, explanation, and so on and so forth, explaining that at the time that he made the decision, he was lacking certain knowledge which has just come to light, and so on and so forth. But at a certain point, he explains, he puts it this way, that all the great people in our history, most of them, the Torah records the fact that they sinned, but they were very fortunate. Some were fortunate. For example, he contrasts David HaMelech with Saul, King David and King Saul. That on the surface, Saul's sin is not as great as David's. Yet Saul lost the kingship, and David was forgiven. And the reason that he gives is because when David was confronted, he just said, Chatasi, I've sinned. He acknowledged his error with no equivocation. But he was saying that David was fortunate because he had someone that could speak to him. The prophet Nathan, Nathan HaNavi, came to him with a very stinging rebuke. He expressed it in the form of a metaphor, of an analogy, and then he pointed him, this is you, I'm talking really about you. And when David saw it, he accepted it. So the rabbi I'm referring to was saying he did not have a Nathan HaNavi in that situation to point it out to him at that time, that he had made a mistake. So what I glean from that is that it's extremely important. It's a privilege for somebody to have a Nathan HaNavi, someone that can speak to you that way, and someone that you trust. There are two factors. Not everybody is in a position where they have that kind of an insight to begin with. You may have people that you trust in your life, but those people do not necessarily possess that kind of insight. more significant than that, maybe they possess that kind of an insight, but they don't have the capacity, they may not have the stomach for this kind of thing. They may not even have the courage. Or they just don't want to upset you. There's certain personalities. That's just not their style. They don't do that. Now, even if you should have an individual who has the insight and has the guts, the willingness to confront you with it, you may have a certain resistance. You may not have that type of trust in the individual. That when the person speaks to you that way, you put everything aside and you listen. Interesting. Rashi points out that Yaakov did not rebuke the sons, and Moshe Rabbeinu did not rebuke the Jewish people until he was close to death. What's the reason for that? And the reason is that there's always a risk with rebuke. Not everybody can take rebuke. And there was always a danger. They could have left Yaakov. They could have ran to Esau. I believe Rashi points that out. People have a certain limited tolerance for rebuke. Not everybody has the capacity to accept rebuke. And instead of listening to what is said, they automatically ascribe motives to the one who's saying it. You don't like me, you never did like me, you're just trying to break me down. You just want to hurt me. Who gives you the right to analyze me, to psychoanalyze me? However, at that stage, when a person is, so to speak, on the verge of dying, then they attain a certain objectivity. People will respect that. This is their last will and testament. It's generally assumed that they have no ulterior motives anymore. So they'll listen more carefully. They won't describe motives. That's why Yaakov and Moshe, even though they were dealing with people on a high level, they took this into consideration. They refrained from giving this kind of rebuke until that point where they could be confident that nobody would say that he was just out to get us. But that's something that's very, very significant. Not everybody has the capacity to accept rebuke, and it's virtually impossible to reach a very high level of perfection without rebuke. Everybody needs rebuke. But the rebuke has to be accurate. It's got to be on target. And therefore, she was very fortunate. Esther was very, very fortunate. You see the significance of the pasuk in pointing out the relationship. Vayhi omein es hadasa. She was fortunate because she had this kind of a relationship with Mordechai. That she had the type of confidence in him that whatever he was saying did not partake, wasn't tainted by a personal motive to put her down. That he was objective, that he had her best interests at heart, that he spoke the truth. And she listened. And she accepted it. And she gave instructions. She said, fast for 3 days, and so on and so forth. She swung into action, and then, Manik, Asher, Avadati, Avadati. I accept that point. That this is what, it's a very harsh kind of a message. In point of fact, he was telling her that this is what the Ashkacha demands. This is what the situation, divine providence demands, that you put yourself in a situation where you put your life on the line. That's what he's telling her. And she accepted it. So it's a very interesting kind of a thing. That's a very important relationship that a person needs in life. In my opinion, everybody needs, in the terms of this, that this rabbi put it, a Nasan Hanavi. Someone who you can go to, or someone who will go to you. David didn't go to Nasan. What about when you do things, and we all do them? And in effect, this is essentially one of the things the rabbi was saying, that he was completely blinded to the fact that he had done something wrong. He was absolutely confident that what he did was correct, and that can happen. We do this all the time. I think this is a problem, especially people who are exceptionally bright and learned and intelligent and think things out carefully. When they make a mistake, it's very difficult for them to acknowledge it because they don't see it. According to the way they're thinking, it makes perfect sense. So therefore, there are times when you yourself don't see it, but others do. And in the case of Nasan, David didn't go to Nasan. Well, Nasan was commissioned. God sent him. God sent him to David. All right, so we don't have that situation today. But the point, nevertheless, is that this should be viewed as a tremendous benefit. To have someone in your life who can play that role, who will see you going in the wrong path and does not have to get involved. And to the contrary, make waves to get involved could risk the whole friendship. I'm sure we're all in that situation many, many times, where you notice that somebody is doing something which is harmful to them. And, you know, it's not going to be easy. Or they're doing something with regard to how they're raising their children or treating their children, whatever the case may be. And you want to point it out to them to help them correct the situation. But you know you're going to make waves. So then very often you make the decision, why should I risk the friendship? Now that could be a very selfish thing. That could be the wrong thing to do. I don't know. I mean, you have to evaluate. If your evaluation is that it's not going to do any good, and it's only going to cause harm, so then you're in the situation of Bush, President Bush. In that situation, discipline. Don't say it. What's the game? But there may be times where it might be difficult, it might be testy, but if you do it the right way, you will be able to get your point across, and you may have to risk. You may have to risk the friendship. That's another type of a situation. But fortunate is the person that has some kind of a individual in their life that can play that role for them. Generally speaking, everybody has a certain romantic fantasy at a certain point in their life. When you're young, when you're a teenager, and you envision finding that certain someone. And you do envision a certain type of relationship that will be there. That this will be the one who understands you, who instinctively knows where you're coming from. But in that fantasy, there's no element of rebuke. You don't have a fantasy that when I do something wrong, this person will be able to rebuke me and I'll be able to listen, or vice versa. Because in the fantasy, you don't have that situation, that anybody will be rebuking anybody. The fantasy of love is that you'll find someone who will simply confirm all of your feelings. The way you feel yourself, that person will feel exactly the way you feel about yourself. And that's what you envision in your fantasy to be, that wonderfulness, that understanding. We see eye to eye. But the we see eye to eye means that we validate each other's fantasies and emotions and instinctive, intuitive ways of looking at things. And that's what you're really looking for. Even though, from an objective standpoint, having someone like that in your life, one has to ask, would that really be good for you? Would an interaction with someone like that, that simply acknowledges and reinforces all of your feelings uncritically, would that really be a positive force for growth in your life? Of course not. But that's why you see that there's such a conflict between what actually does constitute a good partner, a good husband, a good relationship, and the fantasy of what you're really looking for. And that's why there is always a certain amount of tension, because the actuality is not in line with the fantasy. And you have to realize now that having that fantasy come true would be probably the most destructive thing in your life. The next major question that we're going to take up in the Megillah is what I refer to as the plan of Esther. Mordechai had pleaded with her to go before the king and to throw herself at his mercy, to plead and petition for her people. And as we saw, at first she resisted. She had a logical argument, that is to say, that to just appear suddenly without being summoned could risk death. And the way we interpreted it, it wasn't that she was refusing to help. It was basically saying that it didn't make sense to go about it that way, that she should ask for an appointment, go through the normal channels. And Mordechai rejected that idea, because he was saying that in this situation, a situation of extreme danger, in which the odds are stacked against you, you can't go about it through the normal channels. The very fact that you go about it through the normal channels pretty much ensures your defeat. Because people are affected not by what you say, but by the attitude you convey. So they, especially government officials, and whenever there's protests about different things, to a large extent, they are able to gauge the extent of your commitment. And what they're going to try and do is discourage you and put you off. And they'll say, we're going to listen to it, and so on and so forth, because they know that many people are going through the motions. They're doing it because they have to do it, and they'll go back to the people and say, we did everything we could do. We made all the protests, we called all the officials, and so on and so forth. If that's your attitude, then you're pretty much going to be defeated. Because the other side, the government, knows that as well. They know that if they put enough obstacles in your path, you'll give up. That's why many people simply plead guilty and pay a ticket, for example. I know it's a trivial illustration, but even if you know that you're innocent, there are cases like that. Just because you got a ticket doesn't mean you're guilty. And very often, they were wrong. And then you feel outraged, and you are determined you're not going to pay this one, you're going to plead not guilty. But then what happens is, you got to deal with the system. It means you got to take off hours and go down there, and you may do that one time. And then it should turn out that because of a technicality, they couldn't even hear your case that day, so they had to postpone it, and so forth, some other kind of an excuse. Then you're completely worn out, you're totally frustrated, and you don't care, and you'll pay whatever it is and just get this over with. So there is a mentality like that. In that situation, the government wins, because they don't have to go to work. That's their thing. Their thing is to just annoy you. And they have all the time in the world to do that. But you have a life to live. You have to go back, you have your family to take care of and other things, so that's it. And sometimes it makes sense. Even if you're right, what's the difference? It's not worth it. Now, in this type of a phenomenon, when you're dealing about serious issues, you have to understand the same principle applies. You have to use your intelligence. But if the sense that's conveyed is that you're the kind of person that may protest loudly and make an issue out of it and all of that, but bottom line, you can live with the outcome even if you lose, so then you're probably going to lose. What has to be communicated is that when it comes to this, I'm prepared to put my life on the line. That's how much this means to me. This is the kind of an issue that it is. I'm going, like Mordechai went around, tore his garments. He gave up his personal appearance. He didn't care if he looked like a madman, yelling, screaming, hollering, whatever it takes. This is something I can't live with. And that's what he wanted to communicate to Esther, that she precisely has to put her life on the line. She has to use that element of appearing before him unannounced, unexpected, and breaking the law, and for facing the consequences. That is the only way to get his attention in the first place. That was the message that Mordechai communicated. Now, let's pick it up with the reaction of Esther. As we mentioned, Esther was able to accept what he was saying and to introspect, as he had advised her to do. He implied that perhaps the reason why you disagree with me is not because you don't see the point, but because you're concerned about your own safety and you really believe that this is somebody else's problem, that the worst case, it won't affect you. And she was able to accept what he said. And we made a point of that. That's because of the close relationship and trust that existed between them. So then you see her reaction in chapter 4, verse 16, where she says to go and gather all of the Jews that are to be found in Shushan and fast over me, for me, with me, or lie, and do not eat, and do not drink. The 3 days and three nights. And also I and my young girls will also fast. And thus I will go to the king, contrary to the law. Lo chadas. That's precisely the point. And I'm prepared, if I lose my life, I lose my life. That's exactly the point that he was making. That it's interesting, you see how close the relationship was. And you have to assume that he really loved her like a daughter, it says. He raised her. He nursed her, he raised her, he adopted her. You see, he was, how close he was to her. So he must have loved her, obviously loved her very, very much. And precisely the instruction was to put your life on the line. That he was prepared to have her risk her life. Because he recognized that this is what the situation required. And she accepted it. Chasher avadati avadati. That transcended the situation of the Jews, transcended the personal. That's always the hallmark of the true Gedolim, the true great Jewish leaders. There's something that we can learn from this, because at this point in time we don't even know how she's going to go about it, what her plan is. But before doing anything, she instructs them to fast for 3 days and three nights. What's the importance of that? You learn something extremely important in contradistinction to the behavior of the wicked, who act purely on the basis of instinct and impulse and never question themselves, never look into themselves. We pointed it out with regard to Ahasuerus, that he had made a serious mistake by acting on impulse and having Vashti executed, and then it came back to haunt him. But at no point did he introspect and find out what the mistake was. What can I learn from that mistake? No, his advisors came into the picture and they rescued him from that by getting him involved in a new fantasy. Let's have a beauty pageant. But the tzaddik is different. Especially someone who's a great Jewish leader. There's the recognition, not in the sense that most people understand that nothing happens by accident, that there are no coincidences or anything of that sort. There are coincidences in the world. But this type of a thing, first of all, insofar as it happens to the Jewish people, there are no accidents. That's hashgacha. So anything which happens to the Jewish people, and this is not an individual situation, it's for the Jewish people, this is providence. This is divine providence in action. And if it's divine providence in action, then you cannot deal with the situation until you've straightened yourself out with regard to that aspect. That means to say that there's chait, that there's sin. Whether or not it's going to happen, whether or not the Haman's plan will be carried out or won't be carried out, this is an onesh, this is a punishment, because the plan is in effect. And unless something is done, the Jews are marked for destruction. Therefore, we can't do anything at this point. What are we going to do? We're only going to be dealing with the surface situation, with the superficial aspect. The real cause of the problem is not the plan of destruction. The real cause is the fact that the Jews have strayed from the Torah, that they've sinned, and they've made mistakes, thereby allowing themselves to get caught up in this. But there is a lesson for the individual as well. And in the case of an individual, when they experience negative things in life, as we pointed out, you can't always know if it's a specific punishment from God, if it's a specific result of the providence. Nevertheless, a person is always obligated to introspect, to do tshuva. Because it's virtually impossible that something significant can happen to a person in a negative way. Of course, the person's reaction is always to blame it on others. That's always the case. Whenever anything goes wrong in your life, you're always going to be blaming it on others.
And usually there's some truth there because it always will involve others. And others did this, they did the other thing, they didn't listen to you, whatever the case may be. That's all true. But the question is, what did you do? How are you guilty? How did you get into that situation? Why did you trust those people? Why weren't you more aggressive in the situation? So you want to look at the role, which is probably the most significant one, that you contributed to the whole situation. That is more important than any other aspect of it. So therefore, every time a person is involved in a similar type of a situation, before you launch into a plan of action, it's the best thing is to look through your own baggage, to see your own deviations, and to readjust yourself mentally, and to be in an appropriate mental state to deal with the situation. To do tshuva. Do tshuva. Once you've done tshuva, and you've corrected the defects, so then you can make a plan, because the plan demands that you be acting objectively, intelligently, not just acting out your emotions. And in order to do that, you may have to acknowledge things that may be painful to you. If you can't do that, then the plan is going to be defective. Because the plan will have to be limited just to those things that have to do with others, but don't ever deal with the issues in which you're responsible, when you made mistakes. So that's what you see. That in this situation, it's two things. It's the tshuva for the Jewish people. They all have to engage in 3 days of fasting and tshuva. And Gamani, myself as well, she also has to do tshuva. Even though she may have been separated from them, she was in the palace and they were in a different framework, whatever it is, she too has to do tshuva. So that Mordechai accepted. And Mordechai didn't say no, go immediately. He accepted that. 3 days? True, it's a delay of 3 days, but it's not a delay, because this is the beginning of the plan. It's the beginning of the salvation. The next question is, what was the plan of Esther? When you read the next segment, on the surface it seems to be pretty simple. She's made her preparations in terms of fasting for 3 days. And then, of course, she's going to make the dramatic appearance, unannounced. So it says that she dressed up in kingly, queenly, I guess you'd call it, garments. That's for sure. She wanted to make the most dramatic appearance possible. And she stood in the internal courtyard of the king, opposite the king's room. And the king was on his throne. And she made her appearance. So that too is when the king was sitting on his throne. That has significance, as opposed to what? Where else did he sit? I assume that it wasn't during the times when he would be informal. Even a king doesn't sit on the throne the whole time. So he has a private life. And he's relaxing informally. She did not choose to make the appearance at that time. She chose to make it at a time when he was actually in a formal state, dealing with affairs of state. He's sitting on his throne. And then it says, when the king saw her standing in the yard, Nosa Chen Bieno, it called forth a certain amount of favor. So it had a very positive effect upon him. And he stretched out the golden scepter. And Esther approached, and I guess she touched the scepter, the sharvet. That was the protocol. I guess indicating that, whatever, I'm not sure exactly what the point was, but that was the protocol.
What?
So far, so good. And what's interesting is the next pasuk. The king said to her, what is it? What's the issue, Esther? And what's your request? up to half of the kingdom, and it will be given to you. Question, we're trying to understand the attitude of Ahasuerus, because it does seem that she evoked a very powerful emotion in him, if he's talking that way, up to half the kingdom. Whether he meant it literally or not, or whether he would have actually done it or not, we don't know. Perhaps it's just the way he's talking, but to talk that way indicates that he's operating under the sway of a powerful emotion. And we would think it's love. But the pasuk uses the word chen. It says, nasa, so she carried chen in his eyes. Chen, the term chen is translated as charm. It really means when a person has a certain endearing quality. There's something about them that causes them to be liked by others. It's an endearing kind of thing. The idea of Esther having chen, not everybody has this certain quality. This is referred to in chapter 2, verse 15, where it's describing the pageant, when Esther was in the pageant. And her turn came. So she didn't ask for anything. Didn't ask for anything special in terms of the cosmetics. Because all the girls were given a tremendous opportunity to prepare and special cosmetics and so on and so forth. So she didn't ask for anything except what Haggai, the assistant to the king, who was in charge of the women, gave. Then it mentions in conjunction with that, Vati Esther noseis chein, that Esther would curry this favor, this quality of being endearing, v'enei kol ro'eh, in the eyes of all who saw her. And in Pasuk Yud Zayin, when it talks about the fact that she was brought before the king, they had their meeting, it says, v'yev ha-melech az Esther mikol ha-nashim, that the king loved Esther more than all the women. V'tisa chein v'chesed l'fanav. And she brought forth this chen, this charm, and here it is, another word, chesed. Chesed basically is translated as compassion before him. Mikol ha-psulos, more so than all the other virgins. And he placed the crown on her head, and she ruled in the place of Vashti. What's interesting is that it seems to me that it should have simply said that he loved her more than the other girls. It adds that factor of chen, but also in conjunction with chesed, another factor of chesed, what we've translated as compassion. The Targum translates it, umashkecha rachamim. She drew forth mercy. What does mercy have to do with anything? It's telling us is a certain quality that Esther had. There are certain people that have the ability to evoke in others a certain, well, not just love, but it's an endearing quality, and also a certain concern, a compassion. You want to protect them. That's the result of that feeling. That's what they evoke in others. That they're very, very likable in a manner that causes you to want to take care of them and to help them and to protect them. That's what it's saying, that there was love because she was very attractive. It wasn't just that, but it's also modifying the nature of the love. There's different kinds of love. But here, it says that it was like a universal thing. Some people can curry favor in a limited way. That is to say that, generally speaking, whenever you love someone, you have these feelings, you have a desire to protect that person. But that's not universal, that's only with that particular person, the person that loves you, because that's part of love. But that's something else. That's also, bear in mind, it's because it's a selfish thing. The reason why you rush to the protection of someone you love is essentially selfish, because that person means a lot to you. You don't want that person hurt because you're going to be hurt. So it's a selfish phenomenon, and it goes with love. this was not limited to Achashverosh. It says, B'yene kol ro'eha. How do you explain that? A universal phenomenon? Everybody loved her. But it mentions, with regard to Achashverosh, that he loved her. So that was one element. But then also, she brought forth, separate from the love, she also brought forth this reaction, the chayin and the chesed, that she was able to do with regard to everybody. So let's see if we can understand that a little bit more specifically. It's difficult for us to put our finger on it and say what exactly was it that gave her this quality of favor. But in general, the type of people that we have in mind when we talk about people like that, it's not the element of self-confidence per se. For example, a charismatic person is usually someone that's dynamic and that at least gives the appearance of having tremendous confidence, so therefore people look up to them. This is a different thing. This is, generally speaking, someone who is not demanding of others, not threatening to others, but I wouldn't even use the word self-confident. It's not so much confidence, but sort of like not into themselves, not worried or thinking or pushing for themselves. To the contrary, they sort of appear to be very content and concerned about others. Contentness, a certain contentedness, and a certain lack of egotism, an absence of egotism, and to the contrary, a willingness and a positive, a happiness, and a desire to help others. Those are the elements that come to mind. People are naturally attracted to that. They do sense a certain serenity, that this person has a certain serenity, and they also do not sense any hostility. The competitive factor is not there, which kind of like makes people shy away from you. And they do feel a certain importance because this person is nice to you, so that these people make you feel nice. And that's the chayin. That's the likability. And to the contrary, it's more, the pasuk mentions that with regard to someone like Achashverosh, see, it's interesting. It says that Vatiza chayin B'yene kol ro'eha. With regard to kol ro'eha, all those who saw it, it just mentions the chayin. With regard to Achashverosh, it mentions chayin and chesed. So that's interesting, that the chesed factor is not as universal as the chayin factor. That's interesting, because when a person who has that capacity to evoke that feeling, that charm, that makes them endearing, people instinctively like them. And that's a universal thing. There are people like that. That will instinctively be liked for the reasons we've just mentioned. When you combine that with the element of the love of a person who has power, such as Achashverosh, it will also bring forth a protective kind of an emotion. That's the chesed. That he'll look at her with a certain type of compassion and want to protect her. A point is being made that from the standpoint of the Hashkacha, the divine providence, we see the importance of having somebody like Esther with just that quality. Because the point came, the situation arose, where the entire nation was at risk, was marked for destruction, due to the very opposite, the emotion of destruction, of aggression, of hatred, of Haman and manipulating the king. And ultimately, what would save them would be somebody in a position of power in a case where the exact opposite emotion, the emotion of compassion and mercy, would be activated. It's the truth of the matter is, it's only through that factor. The plan of Esther The way she decided to deal with Ahasuerus was not through making a case, even though she makes a case. It was not through argumentation, even though she has the facts and all of that. But essentially, her objective was to really work with his emotions. To work with his emotions, and we'll see more specifically how she was able to manipulate those emotions in a certain way, so that when those emotions were operating in a certain way, then she achieved her objective. And now, in retrospect, we can look back and understand why it was important for the Megillah to tell us these things about her. That the most essential feature about her was that she had chen. She had that endearing quality and the ability to evoke that sense in others, and specifically in Ahasuerus, to evoke that chesed, that element of compassionate concern. And we do see, we don't know why he hadn't summoned her for 30 days. That may not be important. To the contrary, I believe it works in her favor. She did not know. And therefore, when she answered Mordechai, she just practically thinking she hasn't been summoned. So it could be that right now he's not interested in seeing me. She didn't know. How could she know what his feelings are? But in point of fact, it was really a positive thing. It probably was because of other issues. He might have been distracted. But he had very powerful feelings for her. That's very clear. It's very significant. He had very powerful feelings for her. And you could see that. Because when she appeared suddenly before him, at that dressed the way she was, and in that context, in a manner she had never done before, because she obeyed the rules, that had the effect of bringing out a very powerful surge of emotion. It was better that they hadn't seen each other for 30 days. You know, absence always has that effect. But in this case, it brought forth a very powerful surge of not just the love. The love is there, but that tenderness put him in a mood of tenderness, and he wanted to take care of her. That's why he says ad chatzi amachus, which is a lot, anything you want. She had the ability to evoke that kind of a feeling in a person. Not everybody has that, and you have to know, any person that's dealing with people in these different situations, you have to know what the nature of the relationship is. To the extent that you're counting on certain emotions in the other person, yeah, you have to be as accurate as you can be. If what you're looking for is this kind of a response, but it doesn't exist in that kind of relationship, it's not a good idea, then you may have to take a different tack, a different approach. In approaching an understanding of the strategy of Esther, we have to realize that we can rule out one thing. She did not plan to approach him in a logical way to make her point through reason and analysis, argumentation, even in a nice way, to just set forth the facts of the situation. That's not what she did. Although, as I said, she did employ that, she did explain, but the real objective was for him to save the Jews, to change the decree, to overthrow the decree because of certain emotional factors that she was hoping she'd be able to bring into play. That was the strategy. I want to add another fact. We're talking about the issue of chen now. It's become a matter of interest. There's this fact that we've called charm, or the ability to be endearing. Is that something that one can develop, or is that a natural gift? So it seems at this point that most people think that it's a natural gift. I would agree. But I would say that once you can isolate what the elements are, So then it's possible for a person to work on themselves and become more chen-like, so to speak, more endearing, to partake of that more. And one of the elements, I think, is also a certain cheerfulness. That is to say that if a person is not cheerful, if a person is not in a happy mood, that's nothing wrong, there's nothing immoral about that. But generally speaking, that does not have a positive effect upon others. People feel better, feel upbeat, because people in general have a certain unease about life, or pessimistic, and all of that. So therefore, when you meet someone whom you otherwise respect, and this person has a certain optimistic attitude, a certain happiness, a certain cheerfulness, that's attractive. Other people find that attractive. So I think that's also an element in this person who has the chen, that they convey a certain sense of contentment and positivity about life. Now, contrarily, those who are always looking grumpy and unhappy, etc., so that has an effect on others, and people don't find that attractive. It's not an attractive quality. It's interesting to note, just been pointed out, that in the Eshes Chayil, Woman of Valor, so it says that Sheker HaChein, that this element of Chayin is false, the Hevel HaYofi, and beauty is illusory, it's a fantasy, it's Hevel. But Isha Yiras Hashem, he tisalo. A woman who fears God, she shall be praised. So he's referring to Chayin, this factor of charm, as being Sheker, as being false, which is an important point. It's not that we're extolling chen per se. It means that you have a certain reaction towards a person because they evoke certain emotions within you, but that's not truth. That does not bespeak objective truth. And there are many people who can do this, can have this ability, and when you get to know them, it doesn't mean necessarily that they have all the virtues. In and of itself, it's not necessarily a barometer of virtue. One should not say, let's assume a person is dating, that just because you meet someone and they evoke this emotion in you, that's not the real reason why you should just go ahead. You have to investigate and get to know the person. What's it rooted in? Now, in the case of Esther, it was rooted in genuine virtue. She was a tzaddikus. She was a great woman. The pasuk then goes on to say, Isha Yiras Hashem, the true greatness of the woman is that she fears God. That is perfection. Itzalal, she should be praised. So we're saying over here that Esther had this quality of being someone who could evoke chen in others. It's an important quality. Not every person has it. Not every perfected person has it. And to a certain extent, it has to do with other emotions that you may have, and they may be outside of your control. However, it was important that Esther possess this. Bear in mind that Ahasuerus was not connected to her, was not attracted to her, because she was a tzaddikus, because she feared the Lord. On that basis, that's not the kind of woman he was looking for. The reason he was attracted to her was because of this factor, her beauty and her charm, her ability to evoke a certain emotion of endearment in others. And she utilized that. Indeed, that was the purpose of the dramatic first encounter, the way she dressed and the way she stood and the way she appeared. She wanted to bring forth that emotion, and she succeeded. It's also interesting to note that in spite of all of this, knowing that she had this quality, and knowing how the king felt about her, she didn't overestimate herself. Because you could ask, well, if that's the case, why was she afraid to make the appearance in the first place? It seems very easy. Everything seems easy after the fact. But she didn't overestimate that, because she recognized that it was just that. A checker was false. It's an emotion. You can't base your life on the fact that a certain person will have a certain emotion at a certain time. It's an emotion. And because it is an emotion, it's not always going to be present. If it's something that the person is operating on the basis of a certain commitment to an ideal, based on the fact that you are a woman who fears God, that type of thing, so that you can count on. How can you assume that they'll kill you just because that's the law? So what? But you're an exception. She didn't regard herself as an exception to the rule. She didn't overestimate herself. She understood exactly what her ability was, or her power was, so to speak. And that it was the kind of thing which you couldn't always count on. That's why she was reluctant. If he's not in the right mood, and I don't evoke that chen, then I'll be in big trouble. I can get him angry. If the relationship was a different kind of relationship based upon the essential quality that he recognized and appreciated, her fear of God, that would have been a completely different situation. So it was an emotional phenomenon. It was an emotional relationship, and she knew it. It was only because she had no choice. Mordechai had rebuked her. And the message was that in this situation, you have to put your life on the line. So she accepted that. Then she sought, of course, to do it in a manner which would bring forth that emotion. And it actually did. Just that, see, we're reading everything after the fact, so it looks easy. And if it looks easy, so what was she so afraid of? Yeah, it didn't look easy from the vantage point that she had to look at it from.
Today we're going to take up the issue of the so-called plan or the strategy that Esther employed in trying to reverse the decree against the Jews. And there's one other thing. The role of, you might call it coincidence. Well, we're not sure if it's coincidence, but it seems that the strategy was successful. We know that she achieved her objective and the Jews were saved. But was it solely a result of her strategy, or was it a result of factors outside of her control? Now, we would call it divine providence. Or was it some type of a combination thereof? And if so, what was the connection between the two? How did the two factors come together to achieve the result? That's what we're going to be focusing on. Now we're at chapter 5, verse 6. The first phase of the plan to appear suddenly and dramatically when he was sitting on the throne in a very serious situation where she was actually breaking the law and subjecting herself to the death penalty. That phase was very successful because she evoked what she wanted to evoke within him. As we said before, she had the characteristic of what we call chen, of evoking a certain type of endearment in others. And especially in the king, it was chen v'chesed, that he had a certain attitude of protectiveness towards her. That emotion was evoked. Indeed, it's clear that the king had a very powerful emotion for her, because we can see that he was stricken by her sudden appearance. And immediately, it was something of concern to him. Maloch Esther Hamalka. That's in verse 3. What is the problem, so to speak? It was something which was completely unexpected. And what is your request? Up to half the kingdom, and it will be given to you. So right at that point in time, it would seem, it would be a good idea at that point in time to just ask it right away. Why press your luck? But she doesn't say what's really on her mind. Rather, she extends an invitation. If it is good with the king, let the king and Haman come today to the party that I will be making for him. So that's a strange request. It's obviously something that she had never done before. Turns out she's making a party, and she wants the king to come with Haman. Now you can see the response of the king. hurry and fetch Haman to do as Esther requests. So then the king and Haman come to the party that Esther had made. Then the king addressed Esther at the party. What's your request? And it'll be given to you. What is it that you want? Up to half the kingdom, and it shall be done. So you see that his mood has not dissipated, and he's pretty much repeating what he said before. I'm prepared to give you anything that you want. So, of course, the question is even stronger. Why did she not make the request right then and there? Why? What was the point? So Esther said, "Shelosi uvakashasi, my desire, my request." And here she again repeats, "If I have found favor in the eyes of the king." She's appealing to the element of favor. And if it is good with the king to fulfill my request and to do that which I ask, let the king and Haman come to the party that I will make for them, and tomorrow I will do as you say, meaning I'll tell you what's on my mind. At this point, we do not know why she's doing this, because she's passing up on an opportunity to state the request. It also takes tremendous discipline. That's something that we may not appreciate, because generally speaking, when a person is in a situation where they have to make a request, so they have very conflicted feelings, it's a very difficult thing to ask for something like that. So you have to summon up all of your courage. It's like you requested a meeting with the boss, and you're going to be asking for a significant kind of a raise. So you're very on the one hand, you're very nervous to do it. You feel very uncomfortable. On the other hand, you feel like you have to do it, but you can't ask for it right away. So you have to sort of set the stage and set the tone, get into the right kind of a mood. And that's very difficult because you're not relaxed about it. In the back of your mind, you're sort of like thinking, when's a good time to ask? However, when the opportunity does come, then the natural desire is to do it. When you have an opportunity, and then to put it off for another day and to have to go through the entire psychological excruciating difficulty of getting yourself into that frame, that's very, very hard. It requires a tremendous amount of discipline. Take a look at verse 4. And when she asks the king to come to the first party, and then in verse 8, where she asks him to come to the second party, there's a slight change there, you'll notice. In verse 4, when she invites the king, she refers to it as a party, Asher Asisi Lo. That's for the king. The implication is that the party is for the king, and she's inviting only one guest, herself and Haman. Here, when she's inviting them the second night, she's referring to it as the party, Asher Eselahem, that I'll make for them. It's not any more exclusively a party for the king, it's a party for both of them. Which may seem like a small point, but Megillah's pointing it out. It's something that we should bear in mind. What happens after that is this party has a very significant effect on the emotions of two people. The only person that's really in control is Esther. She's holding the cards. She knows what she wants. Her emotions are completely in check. That's extremely important, as we've just pointed out. Even the natural emotion to just come out with what you want, she has it very much under control. But she's put the other two parties in a position where they no longer really have control over their emotions. And we could see that from Haman. Haman walked out on that day, Sameach v'tov lev. She put him in a state of tremendous happiness, a happiness which was not destined to last very long. And when Haman saw Mordechai in the gate of the king, and he didn't stand nor even move, because of him, Haman was filled with burning anger. As we explained, on the surface it doesn't make sense that he would get so angry at Mordechai, because this was nothing new. The Megillah describes that the first time he encountered the fact that Mordechai wasn't bowing down to him, he was filled with rage, but then he was able to deal with the situation. And he engineered the plot to destroy the Jews. Having done that, he could be comfortable now. Didn't bother him, because he knew that it's only a few months and not only Mordechai, but all the Jews will be destroyed. So then you can relax. So what caused him to get angry now? What caused him to get angry now was something that occurs in the emotional life of a person. As we said, there's a difference between how a person deals with their emotions when they're in a state of struggling. They have powerful emotions, but they're able to control the emotion and keep it in check. But once a person reaches a certain state where they're allowing themselves to indulge the emotion, then they can't tolerate any type of even a mild offense. A person, a politician, where knows that he has to control his emotions. Because when he's struggling to get to a significant place, so he has to put up with a lot of insults. And he develops a very thick skin. But once he's arrived and he's being honored and everybody is praising him, then the slightest little insult just destroys the night. He can't take it. That's what she had done. Now, I'm not saying that she knew that this would happen. I think we can define her plan in a general way. There's the general idea of a plan. And sometimes the plan can be effective on secondary level, on a tertiary level, so to speak, on different levels, but you can't anticipate all the particulars. But to the extent that the general objective of the plan was to put both of her protagonists, or antagonists, both of the individuals that she had to deal with, she was really throwing them off their game, so to speak, to put them in an emotional state. So the Megillah first describes the emotional state of Haman. Now, the natural emotional effect of being invited would be that he'd be extremely happy. Of course, it was an illusory type of a thing. He had no idea what he was walking into. That in and of itself was good. He was no longer in a rational frame of mind. That in and of itself is a good thing. You want to take your opponent away from a state of sobriety when they're using their mind and they're thinking. If anything, you want to put them in an emotional kind of a state. You find that, for example, that's a big element in sports. It's called psyching out. And, of course, in warfare. Psychological warfare. Sometimes you want to get them very angry. Like one person will taunt his opponent. The fighter will taunt his opponent. And you'll say, why is he doing that? The other guy's getting really angry and angry and angry. Well, that could be. Sometimes it's good, sometimes it's not good. But it could be good, because the angrier he gets, the less rational he's going to be. So that's the fact that even if he had not seen Mordechai, and had this reaction of anger. Although, as we'll see, it's the reaction of anger which contributes to his own downfall. So, one can say that, did Esther factor this in? Was that her plan? Was she that controlling? That incisive? That she knew that he would walk out in that state of joy? And in that state of joy, he would not be able to tolerate the fact that Mordechai didn't bow down to him and didn't even recognize him, and then that would precipitate his going, gathering all of his advisors and accepting their bad advice to go to the king that night. I don't know that you could say such a thing, because it's just, that's just too much. Nobody can predict the outcome. When you're making a plan, the plan has to make sense in a general way. If it's a very good plan and things are fortuitous, it may work out in ways you hadn't even contemplated. Because since it's a good plan and you're operating along with reality, it may have other consequences. But you can't predict all the particulars. There's just too many particulars over here. And you can't predict that. So, nevertheless, the general idea was to put him into this extreme emotional state. But it's the extreme joy that he felt which was converted very quickly into this extreme anger. And as we've seen, all of the mistakes that the Rishayim in the Megillah, the people that do not live according to the Torah life, all of these losses that they experienced, all of the downfall, had to do with anger. As we will see, Achashverosh made a very serious mistake. Of course, it turned out for the good, for the Jews. But in his context, it was a mistake, which he regretted. When he killed Vashti, he was in a state of anger. And that's why he accepted the bad advice. Haman hatched his plan to destroy the Jews in a state of anger. And we will see, on that night, both of the protagonists make very serious moves in a state of anger. But the decision of Achashverosh, which was in effect to save the Jews, was also made in a state of anger. So you see that Esther clearly did not decide that she is going to make a rational presentation and to try and win the case on the merits. But rather she was going to manipulate the parties into a certain emotional attitude, an emotional state, and in that emotional state, she would make the appeal. So what happens? Vayisapak Haman. Haman was so bent out of shape. The anger he felt this time was much worse than the first time, because he had to just restrain himself. He had to control himself just to be able to get to his house. So what did he do? He couldn't deal with the emotion. So he sent and he brought his friends and Zeresh, his wife. What do you see from that? What does the Rasha do in a situation like that? When things aren't going his way, when he's experiencing a blow to his ego, an affront, can't take it. So instead of searching for intelligent, objective advisors, he brings his friends. That means to say that they're not really independent, and they're not going to advise him in terms of objectively his best interests, but rather they're going to give him the kind of advice that would just deal with the problem in the immediate sense, immediate gratification. Because let's take a look at the actual advice that they give. So it says that Haman told them about the splendor of his wealth and his many children, and how the king had elevated him, and how he had uplifted him over all of the ministers and the servants of the king. Now let's pause and ask, what's the point of telling them that? I assume that they knew this. Well, there's two reasons for this. First of all, his ego has been badly damaged, and he's trying to resuscitate it by reciting all of his achievements in order to gain the respect and the approval of the others. However, it goes further. It's not just that, because he's trying to convince them of something. This is all part of his need to convince them of something. Because he goes on and he says, Aflo hivya Esther, Hamalka, that in addition, this is a further indication of his greatness, that Esther did not bring anyone to the party that she made for the king except me. And also tomorrow I'm invited by her to be with the king. So he gives them this background. And then, V'cholze einenu shoveli, and all this is not worth anything to me. B'chaleis asher ani roes Mordechai Yehudi. Whenever I see Mordechai Yehudi sitting in the gate of the king. What's he saying in effect? What's his message? Is it a message that makes sense, that we can understand? What he's saying in effect is an astounding thing. Of course, he didn't learn the correct lesson from this. And that is to say that all of the things that a person is pursuing in this world are illusions. All the success, all of the wealth, all of the positions, if these things had true value, so then it wouldn't make any sense. How could this be? that all these things are nothing to you. It's one thing to say that these things are very, very important to me, but this is painful to me. That's how most people would say, so then that's life. You can't have everything your way. There are good things that you have, and there are painful things. That's just part of the situation. But what you're saying is that there's one thing, the fact that this person doesn't respect me, renders everything else that I have into nothing. It wipes it all out. Well, you see, it wiped it all out. Because it put him in a state where he just could barely get back to the house. He couldn't control himself. It shows you something. A chacham would learn a lesson. A wise person would learn a lesson from this and recognize that all those things that you're pursuing are meaningless in and of themselves. But at bottom, it's a certain insecurity that you have. It's a weakness. It's an ego need. And you're deceiving yourself into thinking that because you have these things, so you really are important. It's a need to be important. That's why you see that all these things are just give him the opportunity to fool himself into thinking that he's something special. But somehow or other, there was something about Mordechai. Something about Mordechai that he just couldn't shake off. That Mordechai represented a certain truth, a certain reality that he couldn't face. And the reality was that there's nothing here. You're nothing. There's no point in even standing up in front of you. He wouldn't bow to him. He wouldn't even give him any recognition at all. That in terms of reality, you're meaningless. You're nothing. And that came through. That pierced through his awareness. Couldn't deal with that. Haman himself did not have that degree of insight to recognize that there's something seriously wrong, if that's the way it is. Why should it be such a terrible thing? The logical answer to what he said is that forget about Mordechai. On the basis of what you just said, all of your wonderful achievements and your greatness and your wealth and children and everything you have, you should be happy. Why should this bother you? And if it does, then you should look inward. You have a psychological problem. That's what real advisors who truly were concerned about helping the person would have said. But that is the downfall of the Russia. The Russia does not have a true friend to turn to, in contradistinction to the tzaddik. We have seen that the whole miracle of a Purim would not have taken place without the capacity for rebuke. That is to say that initially Esther refused to do what Mordechai said, to go unannounced in front of the king. She refused. And Mordechai harshly rebuked her and precisely told her to look inward, to introspect, to examine her premises and her own emotions. And because she had such tremendous respect for him, because of the relationship that existed between them, if it wasn't for that relationship, then she would have rejected what he was saying. Because on the surface, her position made more sense. The tzaddik has true friends. The Russia has no friends. Because the Russia only has individuals who pretend to be his friend by joining with his own emotions and becoming an enabler, allowing him to satisfy, to gratify his immediate emotions, which only take him on the path of destruction. This is not just an accident. It's integral to the life of the tzaddik that he surrounds himself with true friends. Kenei lecha chaver, acquire for yourself a friend. And as the Rambam explains in the commentary, the true friend is the one who has your real interest at heart, who can level with you and rebuke you and tell you the truth in terms of what's really good for your soul, even though it might be painful. And the tzaddik is the one who wants that, who cultivates that. A genuine tzaddik is one who loves rebuke and doesn't flinch from rebuke, because the person realizes that rebuke is an essential component in a person's perfection, and that if somebody withholds rebuke from you, you can't move forward. That's a hard thing for people to accept, because in dealing with friends and other relationships and so forth, you don't want to be the one who causes this person any discomfort or to feel bad. in general, it's an emotional reaction that the person will like me because I compliment him, because I make him feel good. And if I make the person feel bad, they're going to dislike me. That's a natural feeling. But you have to overcome it. Of course, it's a nice thing. If the situation warrants a compliment, you should be honest. It shouldn't be a phony. And then it's nice. It's nice to be able to compliment someone when it's correct. They tell you shouldn't withhold the compliment. But where it doesn't warrant it, and you're just doing it because of selfish reasons, you want to ingratiate yourself with the person, so then you're not a true friend. The tzaddik, an essential component of the life of the tzaddik is to have a true friend. Is to have a certain attitude towards compliments and rebukes. And like the Rambam says, people that study, he asks them to study his work objectively and carefully, and he's not interested in the praises. He doesn't need letters of praise, but if you find that I've made a mistake, then please inform me, then you'll be doing me a great, great good, and you'll be saving me from a terrible harm to be spreading an idea that's false. To the contrary, the Russia doesn't have any real friends. It's another reason why the Russia, once the Russia is on the path of decline, very rare that he can pull himself out of it. Because pulling himself out of it is only possible if there's truth. But one mistake leads to another mistake, because you're always covering up your mistakes and you're always rationalizing it, and the situation is getting worse and worse. You see that over here. That nobody pointed out to him that his whole idea doesn't make any sense. And that there is no real problem. What the Russia does is to take something which is not a real problem and to make it into a problem. There was no problem. Continue. Go to the party. Be happy. You've got everything. This is nothing. It's a non-reality. But the Russia lives in the world of non-reality. And allows that non-reality to intrude and to become a reality and to start relating it to it like a reality. Then you really get in a situation where you're going to get killed over here. Just clarify something. The fact that Mordechai can bother him so much does indicate that to a certain extent he does have a reality principle. I acknowledge that. And one could argue, well, if that's the case, then it's good. It's only good if he can deal with it in the proper way, if he can learn the proper lesson from it. And that depends upon the advisors. If they could sit down with him and give him proper advice. But since they all share his framework, they're not going to do that. If, on the other hand, he's not going to learn the correct lesson from it, and he's going to deal with it as though the existence of Mordechai is the problem, and Mordechai has to be destroyed, so then it's going to force him into all kinds of irrational moves, which will bring about his downfall. Yeah, there's no question that the lesson we learn is that the life of the Russia in and of itself is an impossible existence. It's a path of self-destruction. Because it's based upon a denial of reality, a negation of reality, and sooner or later, reality is going to manifest itself. As I like to say, reality has a way of asserting itself. So therefore, that is the weakness of that whole life. At certain points, you can't avoid reality, and you're not equipped to deal with reality. Because you're living in the world of fantasy. What is irrational about their reaction? What's their response? Zeresh, his wife, and all of his friends. So they all said, prepare a tree, 50 amos, high. And in the morning, tell the king that he should hang Mordechai on it. And then you'll go to the king, with the king, to the party, sameach, happy. See, that's the approach of the Russia. You've got this great event. Well, that's probably another factor in calling this meeting. That's the immediate need to deal with the situation. I've got this great event happening tomorrow night. This is the greatest night of my life. The second party. I should be enjoying it. I'm going to be going in a miserable state. So they said, not a problem. Just prepare the tree. Get rid of the reality. Negate the reality. The problem is the existence of Mordechai, and you can control reality. So prepare a tree. tell the king, and he'll be hung. And then he'll go with the king to the party, Sameach. He'll be in a good state. So what was his response? Vayitav adavar, lefnei Haman. Vayaseh, it was a very good idea. Why? Because it was perfectly in line with all of his emotions. That's what determines whether the idea is good or not. In my opinion, the advice from a purely objective standpoint is very bad. Because the success of Haman in convincing Achashverosh to destroy the Jews was based on the fact that he was able to persuade him that it was necessary for the sake of the kingship, for the kingdom. The Jews were disloyal and didn't keep the laws and so on and so forth. But he had to completely hide the true reason, his own personal involvement. Therefore, the best thing to do would just leave the situation the way it was. Everything was in place. Everything was working out nice. Why intervene now and risk the possibility of the king seeing through your plan? What's the justification? Why should he be killed now? He's going to be dealt with along with the rest of the Jews. So this is clearly something which is contrary to his way of operating. The crucial chapter is chapter 6, which is referred to as the story of the providence. Things happen that night. Esther is not there. Things are happening. And something very, very strange takes place. It's a very strange series of coincidences. Things are coming together. That night, the king couldn't sleep. Was that coincidence? Or was that part of the plan? Now we're turning to the effect that Esther's strategy had upon the king. He couldn't sleep, sleepless night. We don't know why. So what did he said to bring the records of the kingship. They used to record the events. And they were reading before the king. And they found written, apparently as they were reading, this is what they came upon. Doesn't seem like there was a deliberate plan. Just read. And what did they read about? The fact that Mordechai had revealed the plot of Bigson and Zeresh, who had plotted to kill the king. So that's what they read about. And then the king asked the question, what was done by way of reward? What type of honor was heaped upon him, Mordechai? And then his servant said, nothing was done. That's the end of that conversation. That's part one. Very strange sequence of events. And then the king said, who was in the courtyard? And Haman came to the outer courtyard to tell the king to hang Mordechai on the tree that he had prepared for him. That's very interesting, because it seems that he was a little bit more zealous than the advisors had urged. They had said in the morning, if you remember, they said to go to the king in the morning and tell him to hang Mordechai. But this takes place at that night, during the night. So he comes at night unannounced, which means to say that he didn't even have the patience to wait until the morning. And I would say that it's a further illustration of doing something reckless. Because now you're going to disturb the sleep of the king. It's completely unusual, and you're taking a risk. You don't know what the king is doing. It's one thing to approach the king during the regular hours, when it's normal to have conference with him. But this is at night, it's in his private time, and you don't know what he's doing. What, are you going to wake him up? You don't know if he's sleeping, you don't know if he's awake, you don't know if he's with the queen, you don't know what's going on. So that is further evidence of the fact that he really couldn't control his emotions. Then it says that Haman came in, and the king doesn't, it's funny, the king doesn't discuss the issue. Apparently, all of a sudden, this is very important to him, the fact that Mordechai had not been rewarded. And he says, what is to be done with the man that the king wishes to honor? And Haman said in his heart, Haman thought, who would the king seek to honor more than me. You see, the situation is in a distorted state, totally distorted, and he can only think along one track. No need to ask questions. Generally speaking, in a situation like this, you always want to get as much information. It's one thing to hope that he's talking about you. It's another thing to be so convinced that it has to be you. And Haman said to the king, without any thought, the man that the king wants to honor, they should bring the kingly garments that the king wears, and the horse that the king rides on, and place the crown on his head, and put all of this, give this assignment to one of the lieutenants or the governors of the king, to dress the man that the king wants to honor, and to lead him on the horse in the middle of the city, and to call out before him, "Thus shall be done to the man that the king wants to honor." Then the king says to Haman, "Hurry and take the garments and the horse that you mentioned, and do this to Mordechai HaYehudi, the Jew, who's sitting in the gate of the king. Do not leave anything out from everything that you said." So now, this has to be the worst nightmare imaginable to Haman. So Haman took the horse and the garments and had Mordechai dressed and led him through the streets of the city and called out before him, "Thus shall be done to the man that the king wishes to honor." Then it says that after that Mordechai returned to his place by the gate of the king, and Haman was rushed to his house. Avel v'chafuyrosh. He was in a state of complete devastation, one can imagine. You have to imagine the effect that would have. This was his worst enemy, and he desired nothing more. It's one thing when you're totally disappointed and you don't get the honor, but it's hard to imagine there's anything worse than your rival, the one you hate the most, getting that honor which you covet the most at your expense. And you're the one that has to actually be subservient to him and to lead him around the city and to proclaim his greatness. It's hard to imagine that it can get any worse on the emotional plane. Devastation. Then Haman speaks to Zeresh, the same people, the same group of so-called friends, and tells them everything that happened. And then it says, interesting, then his wise people, now it's referring to them as wise people, but not as friends, but wise people, and Zeresh Ishto, and his wife Zeresh. They say something very strange. If he's from the Jewish people, this Mordechai, that you have begun to fall before him, you won't be able to stand up against him, because you'll definitely fall before him. It's not clear what they're saying. That's not what they said the first time around. What's the meaning of this? What is the fact that Mordechai is a Jew and there's no way that you can stand up against him? It's the same Mordechai that he had been speaking about the day before. They didn't say that. But then it says that while they were still speaking, and the assistants of the king came, and they hurried to bring Haman to the party that Esther had made. That's the end of chapter 6. Chapter 7, of course, is the story of the party and Esther making her request. But what takes place in this chapter? What's the connection? These are the so-called coincidences. What's happening that night? Esther is not there. These are just things that are happening. The king can't sleep, and he's suddenly reading the records. He can't deal with his emotions, the affront of Mordechai not bowing, and he gets this ridiculous advice. As I've said, to me, it's ridiculous to go in the middle of the night and to convince Achashverosh to hang Mordechai. It's kind of amazing that he never actually gets to tell that to the king. It might have worked out differently, you'd think, that here the king is reading about Mordechai. That's what you're expecting. That's what it's sort of leading you to. The king is reading about Mordechai, and it bothers him. What's been done? Nothing's been done to reward him. And then Haman comes in, and you're kind of expecting that Haman is going to suggest that he hangs Mordechai. That would have been an interesting twist, but it doesn't happen that way. It does not happen that way. Instead, he never gets a chance to tell him that. Something else happens. And that is that the king decides to ask him what should be done. And whatever he says, he doesn't argue with it. Fine. Great idea. But then he tells him, now go do that to Mordechai, the Yehudi, the Jew. And of course, this has a devastating effect upon Haman. But what does that have to do with anything? What is the significance of all of this in terms of the overall story? It doesn't lead, or does it? Does this lead in any way to the downfall of Haman? It seems that the key issue is that the next party, she puts forth her request, and the king listens to it and acts on it, whatever. I mean, why is that night so important? So he was humiliated. So Haman was humiliated. But he was still Haman, he was still around. Why did the king deal with the issue in that way? He doesn't present the problem, what's bothering him. He doesn't ask him a question. How come nothing was done for Mordechai? He doesn't do it that way. It does seem that he's adopted a certain type of a hostile stance with regard to Haman. And also, if he wanted Mordechai to be honored, why at the expense of Haman? Why this could have been entrusted to somebody else? It doesn't have to be Haman. It's also interesting that he never really asks Haman why he came, what he's coming for in the middle of the night. He never finds out either. Looking back on the strategy of Esther, our question was, why didn't she just ask the king, make a proposal about the Jews, saving the Jews immediately? And what was the idea of the dramatic appearance? And then she only invites him to the party with Haman. And at the party, she again refuses and makes a request to come to the second party. And it seems to me that any good strategy has to be based upon an assessment of what you're up against, what the issue is, in order to achieve your objective, to win the king over to her argument. And her argument essentially was that the Jews are loyal, that a terrible, terrible mistake has been made over here, that you're killing the Jews because of this idea that they're disloyal. In point of fact, the Jews are loyal, and the disloyal one is Haman, the one who proposed the scheme purely for selfish personal reasons, and in effect disloyalty to the king. It's not in the best interest of the king. That's basically what she wanted to say. But if she just presented that in purely rational terms without paving the way psychologically, there's no way that she could have succeeded. And the reason for that is because, as we saw before, the personality of Achashverosh was such that he was the hedonist, he was the playboy. He wanted to be involved in partying and not involved in the day-to-day running of the affairs of the kingdom. The aspect of decision-making and the power, that type of thing, the glory, that was something that Haman wanted. So therefore the alliance was formed. He selected Haman to be in complete control, and the reason why he gave him all that authority and gave him all that power was so that he'd be able to do everything, and the king would be free. But, of course, all of this is dependent upon one factor, in this type of a relationship, Haman was able to convince the king, Achashverosh, that he was acting completely in the best interests of the king, that he was a selfless servant of the king. And according to Chazal, that he was Mamuchan, who gave the advice to kill Vashti, there too. The whole justification was for the sake of the order in the kingdom, that the women, otherwise the women would rebel, and we wouldn't be able to retain authority, and so on and so forth. He hides the personal motivation. The same is true with regard to the argument about the Jews, that it's for the sake of the king. And according to the interpretation that he offered to put out the money for it, that there's nothing personal in this for me. So he had to lull Achashverosh into a sense of complacency and complete dependence that everything he was doing was for the sake of the king. That is the reason why Esther couldn't just step forward and with the idea out of nowhere that he's acting capriciously, that he's acting purely for his own interest and that he doesn't really care about the interest of the king. It's interesting, she did have a card to play in the entire interaction between them. Bear in mind also that Esther is going to reveal something which is a secret, something the king doesn't know. She has to use that very, very carefully. The secret is that she herself is Jewish, and according to the decree, if it should be carried out, it would mean that she'd be executed as well. She uses that very carefully because she's not using it as a plea to spare her life. That's not her interest. If that were her interest, she probably could have gotten that. Wouldn't have been difficult. And the king could have let, there's always exceptions. The decree would have gone ahead, and of course, if he found out that she was Jewish, he would have saved her. That's not her interest. Her interest is to use that, but only in the framework of saving the Jews, having the king rescind the decree. So that was the objective. The objective was to break down that sense of reliance that the king had placed upon Haman. Therefore, of course, she needed time. She needed time. And she had to place the seeds of suspicion and doubt, suspense. That's what she utilized. She created the impression that there was something very, very big was going to happen. That's why she appeared dramatically. And this already evoked his emotions. And it evoked a strong sense of passion for her. He wanted to protect her. So he offered to do anything. But she wouldn't tell him what it was. And this really bothered him tremendously. But of course, the other factor that she added, that you could say she more or less knew that he wouldn't be able to sleep. Well, you can't predict that, but that was part of the plan, that he'd be troubled. And that's why he couldn't sleep. He couldn't fall asleep. And when he couldn't fall asleep, so all of a sudden he starts reading the books. Is that what he did on a regular basis? I don't think so. The Megillah is pointing out that he read it that night. Why was he reading it that night? Because suddenly he was concerned. He was switching gears from being someone who was completely passive, who didn't have to check up on what was going on, and now he was beginning to get nervous. Now he was beginning to wonder, what's going on over here? And in particular, about this person, Haman. Can I trust this person, Haman? Why is it that she wants only him? She invited him to the first party, and now her desire is that there should be another party, and then just the king and Haman. So all types of worries, the suspense, the fear. And of course you can't eliminate the fear. What's the real fear? What's the ultimate fear in a situation like that? That he's going to lose her. that there's something going on between Haman and Esther, of course. That's the ultimate fear. You do see that later on. How do you explain this tremendous anger that he feels? It's funny. When she finally, in the second party, when she finally expresses what's on her mind. Let's take a look at this. Chapter 7. They get together for the second party. And again, the king asks her, what is your desire? And it'll be given to you. What is your request? Half the kingdom. And then she says, if I have found favor in the eyes of the king, and if it's good with the king, give me my life at my request and my nation. For we have been sold, myself and my nation. See? She always mentioned that, myself and my nation. To be destroyed, to be killed, to be wiped out. But if it were just to be servants, that is to say, if we'd been enslaved, then I would have been silent. Because then it would have been a benefit. If there was, what she's saying essentially is this. If the plan was something which would benefit the king, she's really emphasizing that. That this plan that's been hatched has no benefit whatsoever for the king. If the plan was to enslave us and therefore enrich the kingdom, so then I would have been silent. Because I could see that there was a benefit to the king. And his reaction is very strange, the king. He says, who is this? Who is this person whose heart has been filled to do this? And then she says, this enemy, this wicked person, Haman, this evil Haman. And of course, Haman was completely dumbfounded. Now take a look at 7. The king stood up in his anger. So this filled him with tremendous anger. And he went out to the garden. He had to get out of the place. He was filled with anger. Then, of course, Haman stands up and prostrates himself at Esther's feet in order to plead for mercy. That only makes the matter much, much worse. That's the coup de grace, so to speak. Then the king comes back in and he sees this scene where he's like on her couch, throwing himself at her. But of course he's doing it to plead for mercy, and the king interprets it as being now what you have the chutzpah to seize the queen in front of me. And that's basically, when he said that, then it's all over. And then Carvona steps in and tells him about the tree that he had prepared to kill Mordechai, and the king says, hang him on it. That's the end. That's the downfall. That's the complete destruction. Why did Ahasuerus get so angry? It's funny, because he knew he had given his own approval. He said, "Vakesef no sumlof, the money is given to you to do what you want to do." So what happened? He acts like someone that's never heard about this. Who is this person? And he's filled with tremendous rage. And he can't even stay there. He gets up and he goes out of the room. Was that an act? Or was he really angry? And if he was really angry, about what? It's not, well, it's true. The only thing he finds out now is that she was Jewish. But if that's the problem, he could have said, I'll spare you. What happens on that night is a transformation in the attitude of Ahasuerus to Haman. Because he's looking at the records, and what does he discover? A serious omission, a serious failure of Haman. It was a serious failure because when he reads about the conspiracy to kill him, and nothing had been done. That's very important, because a king, especially in those days, even today, always has to be fearful of these types of plots, especially when you have this tremendous empire. So there's always people that are planning, plotting, and so forth to assassinate. Therefore, what Mordechai did was a great thing. Mordechai wasn't part of the official a government, the Secret Service, or the protection, or anything like that. Yet, when he got information, he didn't have to, but he passed it on. And the life of the king was saved because of that. So don't you want to set an example? It's very, very important to make a public example. Not just as a matter of hakaras hatov, you know, to be thankful, to recognize Mordechai, that's true, but beyond that, to demonstrate to the public the tremendous honor if a person acts this way, because you want to encourage other people to do the same thing that he did. If this could happen once, it could happen again. So that's a very serious omission. And when Haman showed up, it seems that at that point on, from that point, he has a certain distance from him and a certain hostility towards him. Because he doesn't discuss it in a rational way. He doesn't even give him a chance to explain himself. Doesn't ask the question of why he wasn't honored. What were you thinking? That's the way he would have approached it, normally. And normally this type of a thing would not even have bothered him. He wouldn't even have known about it. But there's a transformation in the king. That is to say that in general, he was very, very passive in giving Haman whatever he wanted, but he did have the capacity to become proactive, to become independent. There was a transformation. It had been started, the process had been started by Esther, because Esther placed suspicion and fear. And that fear directly related towards Haman. That was the idea of bringing together, to create a situation of suspense, of something unknown, something very, very major, and it had to do with Haman. That's clear. And that's as far as she could go. Because other than that, she couldn't control. She couldn't control that he would be up that night. Maybe he'd fall asleep. The other factors, what people might call coincidence, but the factors of Ashkacha come into the picture. The Ashkacha works it out fortuitously that he couldn't sleep. And fortuitously that when they instruct them to read the history books, that's the place that it's open to. For whatever reason, we don't know. That's the thing that has the effect upon him. That's the way things happen. A lot of things have an effect upon you. Not in and of themselves, they may not be that significant, but because of the mood you were in at that time and somebody brought something up, it has a traumatic effect upon you. Traumatic, it can be that way. You could be feeling very, very guilty about something for whatever reason, and you're in a certain state and you're very, very vulnerable. And then something else can be brought up, which you wouldn't even have thought of, and if you had, it wouldn't have been insignificant, but in that state of mind, it assumes tremendous proportion. That's what's happening over here, and these things are outside of your control. The control of Esther, of people, goes so far, but that's where the providence kicks in. If a person is acting in line with the true ideas, with God's will, then the providence assists you, and it takes over. It's working in the same direction. It's bringing about the fruition. She had the right idea. This was the right plan. But there are circumstances now that she can't control. That's where providence comes in. And you could see that this was a hostile encounter. He doesn't even ask him what he's there for. He doesn't even ask him about the case of Mordechai. What should be done? What is it that should be done? And he knows that Haman loves the honor. He knows that he loves the glory, and he elicits it from him. And that has to have an effect upon him too, because it shows clearly where his mind is at. And then he really puts him in his place. This is a very serious separation between the two. He now is a different king. He's a king who's taking control, who's being active again, and he's put Haman in a completely different position. Haman is now in a very subservient position. This is now, Haman said, one of the king's assistants, one of the governors, so to speak, one of the cabinet, one of the king's ministers should lead this man around. But not someone like me, not someone that big, that's too big. But he was treating him just like another minister. That's all you are. You're just a minister of mine. And he had taken Haman off the pedestal, so to speak. So at this point in time, he's not about to go further. He's not going to punish him, whatever. We don't know what's going to happen. but there was a serious alteration in terms of the relationship between the two, thus paving the way. Thus paving the way. What takes place at the second party is that the picture that Esther presents to him, paints before him, is something for which he is very, very mentally prepared to listen. The idea that Haman is not someone who acts in the best interests of the king, but Haman is a person who has his own agenda, that's something which he himself is very, very prepared for. Because he saw that there was a serious omission, that someone who saved his life, nothing was done. And why? Because he's Jewish. Let's register. All these things are beginning to register. Then, there's one other thing, though. And that is, essentially what she's saying is, that this evil and wicked person is acting purely for his own interests. There's no benefit whatsoever that will come to the king from destroying the Jews. That's important. But there's another very powerful emotional issue over here. And that is that his plan would have caused the destruction of your wife, of me. That's in effect what she's saying. He's in a state where his emotions of love and protectiveness have been aroused. And in addition to everything else, that's one thing. But basically, this person who presents himself as being completely in your interest, in effect, is telling you to do something which would lead to destroying your own wife. He's even prepared to take me away from you. That, I think, is what engenders the tremendous anger. And in line with the pshat of Chazal, in line with the idea that this is Mamuchan, it could even reactivate the anger that he felt because of the advice about Vashti. He had received this advice before. But as we saw, after the anger wore off, he remembered Vashti. He remembered that incident. What she had done, and the decree, and he remembered that the whole thing didn't make any sense, and he was upset. But then he was able to repress it, because they got him into this other fantasy of this pageant, the beauty pageant. But now it all came back. And when he said, who is this person whose heart was filled to do this, that means to say that he's now looking, of course he knew what the plan was, but that's not the plan that was presented to him. When he agreed to the plan, it was something which made sense, practically speaking, to protect the kingdom, and so on. Now he sees this plan completely differently. This was a plan purely for his own self-aggrandizement, and which was contrary to the interests of the king. It's a different kind of a plan. It's a plan which is destructive. You're going to destroy a people, the loyalty of which he had just seen in terms of Mordechai, a people who was loyal to the king, and a plan which would actually destroy the queen. That filled him with rage. Could be that there was a lot of anger at himself for putting such trust. When a person gets angry, there's many, many reasons. Again, it's completely an irrational phenomenon. In the end, it's the emotion of the Russia which determines his action, and that's exactly what she based herself upon. The wisdom of her plan was that she did not seek to appeal to rationality, but she used the arguments, the correct arguments, that the Jews are loyal, and Haman is evil and selfish, and does not have the interests of the king. That was the argument. But in order to get it through, she had to utilize the emotions of the king, to work with the emotions, but not to appeal on the basis of logic. And when he was in a state of extreme anger, in that state, that's the one in which he gave the order to destroy Haman. Of course, other factors. Haman blundered, and he threw himself at her feet. He wasn't thinking at that point in time. He couldn't control himself any longer. And the king left momentarily. Then when he came back, that was the clincher. But you see the difference between the life of the tzaddik and the life of the Russia. all of the key activities, all the key events of the Russia have to do with anger. And that's their downfall, that's their destruction. And to the contrary, the success of the tzaddik is because he's able to completely control the emotions and to operate in terms of the reality, even in a situation where it goes contrary to ordinary logic. In the case of Mordechai, when he refuses to bow down, he's acting in terms of truth. That's the ultimate truth. There's something more significant even than physical existence, the state of my soul. I can't accept idolatry. And of course, in the situation of Esther, when she makes a decision, which is, again, it's an impractical decision, to appear suddenly unannounced. It's a dangerous decision. But the ultimate reality, the reality of the situation demands that that's the move that you have to make. That's the contrast between the life of the tzaddik and the life of the Russia. That could be the reason we started with the question as to why it's mentioned that in the days of Mashiach, all of the scripture, except for the Chamisha Chumshei Torah, the five books of Moses, all the other books, the prophets and so forth, will no longer have the same status as holy writings, except for the Megillah. Because essentially, all of the other writings have to do with the phenomenon of rebuke, or the fact that they depict the Jews living in different situations and not living in accordance with perfection and having to be rebuked. Or, of course, the writings like the Tehillim, the Psalms, and other writings which seek to guide a person on the correct path. But in the days of Mashiach, when mankind will achieve a perfection, so then, of course, you'll need the five books. That's Torah. Torah is the abstract system. And the Megillah. The Megillah really reflects this idea, the contrast between the two ways of life. The life of the Russia, which leads to destruction, that's the philosophy. And the life of the Tzaddik, which on the surface, even though it seems to go against one's emotions and even one's sense of practicality, but since it's rooted in reality, it's the life of success. That's the life of the Tzaddik.